One of my favourite websites is The Conversation, which delivers an email every morning and a bunch of articles about the news written by academics around Australia. They contribute to it, up it goes. They're experts in, might be in negative gearing, for example, today. So they'll, because that's their area, they'll write an article about it. So it's very, very informative. I'm not sure what was in the news that prompted The Conversation to keep publishing articles on birds this week, but I love them both. And, you know, I'm not like a huge bird watcher, but I like them. I like birds. I like the fact that in Sydney, we live in a city of birds. I like the fact that across New South Wales, lots of birds. It's a good thing. Beautiful, beautiful thing. So there were two articles written. One suggested that our birds are really bright, very, very smart, as smart as chimps. Huh? Africa, you can keep your chimps. We got magpies. The other suggested that there were bunches of birds that we don't like, particular birds that as humans, we start to resent their intrusion into our life. You know, there's the miners. Oh, there's the ibis. Why do we dislike these birds? How can we perhaps change our mentality? Is there something we need to do to change their behaviour? So we're going to explore both of these this afternoon. Catherine Lambert, who's the expert on the birds we hate, will join us this afternoon. And Professor Gisela Kaplan, who's a professor of animal behaviour at the University of New England, author of Bird Minds, Cognition and Behaviour of Australian Native Birds, will be along with us as well. You're welcome to join in. 1-300-222-702 is our number. Perhaps you've got some views on the birds we dislike. Perhaps you've got some good stories about how smart your local birds are. Somebody's already texted and said, our eastern long-billed Corella can unlock puzzle boxes. And here's a video of him unlocking his newly configured puzzle box for the very first time. So join in however you prefer. 1-300-222-702 is the number. Hello there, Gisela Kaplan. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine. Thanks, James.
Lovely to have you along. And let's just make sure Catherine Lambert's with us as well. Hello, Catherine Lambert.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Lovely to have you here, and thank you for joining us. Gisela Kaplan, this is a stunning statement at the end of your article where you say the lives of native birds are complex and depend on more than instinct to survive. This includes a superb long-term memory, minds capable of complex behaviour, extensive communication and good decision-making. Our birds are curious, emotional, smart and adaptable. Is this a new way of seeing Australian birds?
Well, I hope so. If anybody else hasn't seen them that way, then it's high time they do.
Yeah.
And this is not just opinion, there is a scientific basis to all these wonderful claims.
Yeah, yeah. We're seeing this sort of change in how we view animals in general. What are some of the examples of the ways in which Australian birds are particularly bright?
Well, you weren't happy with the chimp idea, but if you think of palm cockatoos being able to manufacture tools, that's about the highest level of tool use you can have, and that was meant to be unique to humans. So, and that took humans a long time to invent. So we are talking about areas of problem solving, tool using, having a memory that lasts for very long and so forth, that hadn't been thought possible of animals or of birds at all. In fact, you know, bird brain wasn't usually meant as a compliment, James, was it?
Yeah, that's right. Bird brain was an insult. So what tool does the palm cockatoo use? What does it do?
Well, the palm cockatoo has never had the kind of media attention that the New Caledonian crow had, you know, when it started manufacturing tool and was discovered to do so. The palm cockatoo does a very clever thing. As you know, most cockatoos nest in open nest holes, and I've often wondered how they cope with all the rain in the monsoon period and see what happens to the eggs. Well, the palm cockatoos have solved the problem. They actually make a ramp inside the hollow and lift that up high enough and calculate that correctly enough that it doesn't drown, and then jam the pieces in. And in order to do so, they actually have to cut the pieces exactly the right length. And then they do them crisscross, and the female then lays out her nesting thing on top of that. So that's very clever. The Eclectus parrot, for instance, doesn't do that, and many of its eggs literally disappear in water.
Wow. So it's making a ramp for drainage.
For drainage, and so that it's high enough above the flood level of the water that it might reach in the nest hollow.
That is pretty incredible, isn't it? I mean, I've thought of things when you say sort of tools. I think it might be crows or something. We'll use a stick to poke at things, and that's pretty good. But you just described design, cutting
exactly. Cutting to size, and these these hollows don't come to exact length, so they need to have a pretty good idea exactly as carpenters. How long the stick has to be, because if it's too wide, it jams in an angle, and that's certainly not possible. Mm. If it's too small, it'll just fall through. So there's a lot of skill involved in that. And, of course, palm cockatoos, which some people know, also use a stick for drumming, and they sometimes use a hollow log in order to make that drumming sound look and sound a bit better.
Wow. And why are they drumming?
Well, the idea is that on one hand they want to impress a female, on the other they may well do this just as a territorial defence. But the fact that they use a drumstick and drum it on a hollow log is very impressive. But when you hear their voices, I don't know whether anybody's ever heard the voice of a palm cockatoo. We are all used to the sulfur-crested cockatoos being extremely noisy, and the palm cockatoo is the opposite. It's like it had a voice operation. It's the most puny, shrieky little sound that's barely audible despite the size of the bird. So there you are. And it has that aid in order to achieve something, and that, of course, is meant to have been a very unique feature of human innovation.
Yeah, yeah. Gisela Kaplan is with us, Professor of Animal Behaviour at the University of New England and author of Bird Minds, Cognition and Behaviour of Australian Native Birds. You can join us, 1-300-222-702, if you'd like to join in. Perhaps you've got questions or comments, particularly on how clever birds have appeared to you. Catherine Lambert is joining us. She's a Research Associate at the University of New England as well. Catherine Lambert, good afternoon. Let me just make sure I've got Catherine on the phone. Sorry, Catherine?
Yep, I'm
Hello.
Still here.
Yeah, excellent. Now, how can we hate any of these birds, Catherine? It just seems wrong, doesn't it? Look how smart they are, and here we are sort of bagging them out.
A lot of the birds that people tend to hate, or at least dislike, the birds that compete with people or remove the birds that people think are pretty, like fairy wrens and that type of thing. So in this case, it's the noisy miner or the bell miner.
Yep. Yeah, so we end up hating them because we think that they're taking habitat from ones we quite like.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's a funny sort of. It seems obvious, doesn't it? I suppose we like the ones we like because we think they're a little bit prettier or they sound nicer or something like that.
Yeah. So in the case of the fairy wren, it's a bright blue colour and it makes a pretty little song.
Yep.
So that could be a reason why people prefer it, say, over the noisy miner, which is really noisy and aggressive.
Yeah. Nasty little thing, really.
Yeah.
See, I end up doing this. My particular bug is the ibis. So the ibis in the city is just blah, horrible bird.
Can one intervene?
Yeah. Can...
Before this goes down a horrible track,
yeah. Gisela, are you worried about my tendency I could hunt the ibis quite happily, you know, ghastly little thing.
Well, they don't have a very attractive head, do they?
No.
I mean, but then looking from the point of view of some coloured feathered birds, we look pretty silly naked as we are.
Oh, yeah, so you think the parrot looks at us and goes, gee, they're
ugly little
that
thing,
that is a stinking species, that human.
Not a bit like neonates, you see.
Catherine, is it more to do with the, when particular birds, come into our environment? Do we end up ruining them in a way?
Well, I found that with these two species that I looked at in the article, the noisy miner and the bell miner, most of the reason why they are a problem, particularly in urban areas, is because we've removed their habitat. So they've basically adapted to the area, utilised the resources that we've provided and chased out other birds that can't compete as well with them.
Mm. So we end up blaming them, but it's our behaviour that's either altered their habitat or created habitat for them.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, because I mean, my understanding is, like, say, with the ibis, is that this is exactly what they're looking for. There's lots of spare food all over the place. It's terrific.
Yeah, so ibis are one of the species that prefer a lot of dump sites because there is a lot of food there for them, and a lot of other species will compete with them for that resource.
Yep. Yep, Catherine Lambert's with us. We're talking about the birds we hate and the birds we love, I suppose. The ones we like are the really smart ones. Gisella, you got the right end of this argument, I think, this afternoon.
Well, actually, this is not quite true. We dislike the birds sometimes that are smart because they're invading our spaces. And they learn to adapt, and they may come into the garden and pull out every garlic plant interfere with a dog food or get to the back of the... So sometimes, you see, when we have crows, for instance, some people hate crows. So they're amongst the most intelligent birds that we have. The Peruvian crow is one of the first that has solved the problem of the cane toad.
Right.
And is actually capable of killing it without getting killed itself. So it has actually solved a very, very difficult problem. And how that Tauresian crow did that, I do not know.
So it solved, so it figured out how to kill it, so and then it can consume it without getting poisoned?
Exactly.
So it knows which bits to eat? Or is there
exactly. Right. So there must have been very, I mean, how do you, it's not that it had taken a class and said, look here, there are glands on the upper part of the frog, and be careful of that. So the birds actually had to figure that out themselves, and they have. Unbelievable story of insight and problem solving.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So this is so basically, if we made a human analogy, this is the same as a group of humans years ago trying to figure out how to eat stuff that might otherwise be poisonous. So unfortunately, some people would have to die, some people would have to get sick, but that information would have to be passed along.
Well, not only that, but you have to, James, you have to make the connection that the thing that killed the person or the animal was actually connected to the use of or eating of that particular thing that it ate, you see. So to make that connection is not automatic either. So that requires something. We now know, you know, we should always check what we've eaten when we feel sick, but that's not automatic.
That's right. I'm just seeing the crow sitting around. Did he have cane toad last night? I reckon he had the cane toad last night. That's what's wrong with him today. Tom?
Yes, James.
Tell us about your Eastern long-billed corella.
Monty, he's about 2 years old, and he likes to play with his puzzle box, which is a series. It's a box which contains a cashew nut, and it has a series of five or six interlocking devices which have to be opened in sequence before he can actually get to the cashew nut.
Right.
And that'll involve undoing a nut and a bolt, lifting and sliding a cabin bolt, removing a pin, opening the door ultimately. It was inspired by some research done by the Goffin Institute of Vienna, where they experimented with Goffin parrots.
And can you reset this box for different combinations?
Yeah, I reorder the locks and present it to him again. And I think the video that I showed you, that was the first time he's been presented with a reconfigured lock, and he got it done in, I can't remember, I haven't got the video in front of me, but it was a couple of minutes.
Right. Have you given him a Rubik's Cube at all? See how he goes with that?
He'd love that. He would break that down into its constituent components in about 30 seconds.
Yeah. Gisella, this is what strikes me is that, you know, when we have a pet bird, when we bring a bird into our life like this, you know, we're always struck by how smart they are. They imitate sounds. They start to, you know, we know that they can understand what's going on.
Yes, well, actually, the most popular pet worldwide is the budgerigar.
Mm.
And the budgerigar, we've just done all the measures of brain size versus body weight and the kind of problem solving it can do. And apart from the palm cockatoo, it is the smartest. And it even has a record in the Guinness Book of Records of one particular budgerigar memorizing 1,700 or something words. So memory is also measurably very good, and memory for sounds is extraordinary.
Mm. If it can do 1,000 words, then It must be able to recognise all that. That might just be the ones it can say, right?
Well, there might be just the ones that can say, and some of it may be just what we call parroting or mimicking.
Right.
But in other cases, you see, there's clear evidence that they've learned the word and understand the meaning as well.
Wow.
And I give you that little story. I think I wrote that in that little conversation story of the magpie sat on a stump and the cat wanted the bird gone. And the magpie, had learned the name of the dog, called the dog. The dog came running, chased the cat away, and the dog was the magpie was still sitting on the stump preening.
Wow.
So clearly in that context, learning the word of the dog had meaning beyond a kind of mimic sequence because he'd know things would happen afterwards which would help him stay.
Mm. We're talking about birds, the ways in which we interact with them in our lives. Giselle Kaplan is with us from the University of New England and author of Bird Minds, Cognition and Behaviour of Australian Native Birds. Catherine Lambert's also from the University of New England. Is it a hotbed of bird research there, Catherine Lambert? Is this why you are, there's so much coming out from your university on birds?
I think there's just a few people that are really interested in birds, and we have the Avian Behavioural Lab there now as well. So there's a lot of researchers doing work on cognitive abilities and that type of thing, and particularly in urban areas. So
right.
Probably why there's so much research.
Is your suggestion that with some of those birds that we perhaps have, you know, we're not taking them to heart, that we should try to start to understand why they're there and enjoy them in the same way that we enjoy the blue wren or the kookaburra?
Yeah, I think it's more the birds that people are used to seeing in their garden. So maybe if people take more notice of what's coming in and out, they might observe more interesting behaviours and become more attached to other species, not just the normal ones that they'd see, like the fairy wrens.
Yeah. So we can start to, if we start to appreciate what the noisy miner is up to and how they're, what they're doing, we can start to enjoy them as well.
Yeah, because they are very charismatic and they're a cooperative breeder, so they hang around in their little families and make lots of noise and have little conversations between each other and that type of thing, which is rather interesting.
Mm. Can we teach them to sound a little nicer? It's an ugly sound.
Possibly, but I doubt it. That's their unique call. So.
Yeah. Well, someone says someone's texted and said, look, we like birds that fit into our idea of nature. Interesting, pretty and sort of in its place. We have a sort of preconceived idea, I suppose, of what should be there. So, you know, we need to understand that it may not always turn out like that.
Yeah, so a lot of people have these ideas based on where they grew up and the types of birds and animals that their parents pointed out to them when they were a child. So it's part of their folklore as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you know, to come back to the noisy miner, perhaps, if I can, James?
Yeah.
That call that you say is ugly actually is an alarm call. And the sized bird it is a fairly small bird. It has absolutely no defences. And the fact that they can group together and be a cooperative species and help each other has also meant that they've become something like the policemen of the bush together with a magpie. They often team up with the magpies if there is a real danger in the area.
Oh.
So I only need to follow a group of noisy miners and I can distinguish the alarm calls. They're actually different ones. And there's a specific one for snakes, there's one for lace monitors, and there are calls that are general panic. And the general panic one, they all group together. And they can, this is only what they do when a bird of prey is very close, or a channel-billed cuckoo gets close to them.
Mm.
And one of the things, strategies they have, if they all call at the same time, it sets off wavelengths that is so painful on the eardrums that is the most effective way to get rid of the predator.
Wow.
And the goshawk will actually fly away. It just can't bear it.
Mm.
And the panic one, in fact, is just a very emotional and very, very heartbreaking sort of sound.
Mm.
I've seen channel-billed cuckoo take live nestlings, ready almost to fledge of that size, and swallow them whole and alive. And they were totally defenseless. So You know, they have a lot of enemies as well, but they're very vigilant, and that helps many other species to survive.
And, I mean, what's fascinating there is you're almost like you could be describing humans. You know, we're kind of defenceless, and we group together and figure out strategies to work together to alive, to stay alive, to survive.
And Australia's a hot spot for cooperative behaviour in every which way. And when you look at the continent and how many difficulties it throws at any of the native animals, it is absolutely remarkable that they survive. But they have learned to group together to defend themselves and to develop strategies.
You're saying sort of this bird is a very smart bird and the budgerigar is the smartest bird. Are we just waiting to study all of them to find out that they're all pretty smart, or are there actually differences between which is a smarter bird?
There are enormous differences. As in humans, I hate to think that one day Martians come down here and take one of my failed PhD students as a sample of humanity or something, you know. So there is enormous variation.
But is that individual, like you can get a dumb crow or all crows?
You can get a dumber crow and you get a brighter crow.
Right.
But the variation within species is smaller, of course, than in between species. But we've actually, I've just done that.
What's a stupid bird?
On average intelligence, let me put it this way, Australian birds are exceptionally smart because they're also very long-lived. They have long periods of development. And the brain is a very expensive organ in the body, so it takes forever to form it. Right. It needs a lot of feeding, and it needs a lot of time. And they have time to play, they have time to grow, and when they have done so, they also live very long. So experience can add a little bit of that. So, in fact, their average intelligence of 500 species, I've done it for 500 species, is extremely high average and much higher than the European ones. They won't like that.
Right. What are our stupid birds?
The very clever ones are the bowerbirds, for instance, the musk lorikeets. All the cockatoos are way, way above the crows and the magpies and the butcher birds, and well below are some of the shore birds and water birds.
Right.
And I don't think you need as many as much resourcefulness as you do when you are a land bird, where you really have to find your food over long periods of time.
Isn't that interesting? So it evolves. You end up, the smart ones are the ones that survive. So
the smart ones are the ones that
survive.
Whereas
you're a water hen or something, there'll be bugs everywhere. You'll be fine.
That's right. I mean, some species have survived being not very smart, but have been programmed in such a way that it's sufficient for their purposes. And at shore and water level, perhaps that is true. But if you have a flora and fauna, as in Australia, that's so fickle and so unreliable that something fruits and then it doesn't fruit for years, and there are fires and there are droughts and there are storms. I mean, nothing is reliable. Mm. You need to remember when something can flower and produce fruit, or other animals may be around. And that means you also need to have a very good spatial memory and you need to be extremely flexible.
Yeah. Georgie, thanks for calling us. Now, you quite like the bush turkey.
I do. I'm a real fan, but my neighbours aren't so excited about them.
Yeah, well, this is another one, isn't it, where, you see one perhaps out in the bush that's like, wow, it's quite big, it's, spectacular in a way. When they're in the backyard and you think they're going to dig up your veggies, not quite the same relationship.
Yeah, well, I guess I live right near the Lane Cove National Park, so I kind of think in some ways I'm on their turf.
Yeah.
But, and I also think, like, when they come, they sort of have a circuit, so they come through my garden pretty much the same time in the morning and the same time in the evening.
Right.
And, for example, like, I've got cherry tomatoes growing. Mm. But they'll only just, like, they'll get the most ripe ones, but they only take a couple. They don't, like, destroy the bush or anything.
Oh, that's very nice of you that you're growing, you're sharing. That's very good. Catherine, the bush turkey, through the Central Coast and in the some of the suburbs of Sydney, that it's getting to the sort of minor and ibis level. You get this sort of, this people very angry about them and other people quite enjoying them.
Yeah, it's like that in Port Macquarie as well, because they run around in areas where people are and people have started feeding them, so they assume that everyone's going to feed them. So some people are getting annoyed with them now because they're stealing their food.
Yeah.
Another case of we're causing the problem.
Yeah. It's a marvellous and complex relationship that we have with our bird life. It's been terrific to explore it with you both. Catherine Lambert is a research associate at the University of New England. And Gisella Kaplan, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, James. Thank you.
Love to have you along. Professor of Animal Behaviour at the University of New England. Her book is called Bird Minds, Cognition and Behaviour of Australian Native Birds. And you can read the two articles that inspire this conversation on the Conversation website.